Striking an ascetic pose in the church sanctuary, St. Augustine, 354 to 430, knelt for a brief instant, as motionless as one of the chamber's stone columns, while the voices of men and women in the choir gently intermingled in a simple, haunting melody, rising and falling like incense in the musty air. The sound wafted gently along the cathedral's walls, intoxicating, sensuous, even seductive, as wily and dangerous as voluptuous Eve's enticements to a hapless Adam. Flooded with the pleasure of it, Augustine burst into tears, surrendering to the experience had distracted him from the Word of God, a venial sin, and he was gripped with guilt. For centuries, philosophers had warned of music's ability to manipulate emotions, provoking sadness, igniting fervor, even enfeebling the mind. Augustine was a witness to the danger, and he recorded his experiences in his Confessions. 4 centuries after he penned them, religious authorities were still grappling with the issue, though no longer warning about the threat of beguilement. Instead, they began to consider how the very tones that had led Augustine astray could be harnessed in service of the church's mission. In his time, each region under the Pope's reign was caught up in its own way of speaking and thinking, including particular approaches to intoning the sacred hymns. "I myself could hardly believe it," noted Notker the Stammerer, circa 840 to 912. One of the leading literary and musical figures of the early Middle Ages. How widely the different provinces, nay, not the provinces only, but districts and cities, differed in the praise of God, that is to say, in their method of chanting. That lack of unity, in the view of religious authorities, robbed the kingdom and the church of their full power. They wondered, what if the disparate groups could all be coaxed into singing with a single voice, thereby forging a united people out of a sprawling polyglot kingdom? It might actually allow the Holy See finally to triumph over a disordered world, though in fact, putting things in such order seemed a task beyond the abilities of mere mortals. The job was taken on by Charlemagne, 742 to 814, also known as Charles the Great, the fierce warrior who brought under one rule the individual regions, and for his efforts was crowned Holy Roman Emperor by Pope Leo III on Christmas Day in 800. Charles was the son of King Pepin the Short, ruler of the Franks, who purportedly demonstrated his might by piercing a lion's neck and severing a bull's head with just a single blow. According to Notker, Pepin's followers fell to the ground at the sight of this, and instantly declared his authority over all mankind. Charlemagne inherited his father's grit and succeeded him as defender of the faith. He was tall, towering over most of his contemporaries. Whether done up in gold-embroidered robes on feast days or wearing a simple tunic, he would always have a sword by his side, especially a cherished one, made with a hilt of gold and a jewel-encrusted scabbard. Standard dress for the Franks included gilt-covered boots with red thongs, a rich linen shirt, and a buckled sword belt covered in leather and hard, shining wax. A stick of applewood was traditionally carried in the right hand, with regular knots, strong and terrible, according to one witness. The king's martial skills unfailingly rattled the spirits of foes. Nithard, son of Charlemagne's daughter, Bertha, claimed that Charles managed to tame the wild and iron hearts of the Franks and barbarians alike through a form of mild terror. In fact, his name was whispered with such awe that it became part of a well-known magical incantation, the so-called Charlemagne's Prayer, used to invoke Jesus' help in resisting the devil and securing protection against enemies, natural disasters, and illness. But the idea of compelling everyone in his domain to sing hymns in exactly the same manner faced insurmountable obstacles. Some groups, Notker explained, torn with envy of the glory of the Franks, determined to vary their method of singing so that Charles's kingdom and dominion should never have cause to rejoice in unity and agreement.